This is Jane Selinsky, September 10th, 2010. C.G. Jung's Red Book, Artist Mandalas and Active Imagination Revealed, Artistic Influences on the Development of C.G. Jung's Red Book. This was recorded on DVD, and there were a number of images in this DVD. It's in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
Well, I have the privilege of being on the program committee for the Seattle Jung Society, and so we get to find treasures around the country and bring them to Seattle. And Dr. Jane Selinsky is truly one such treasure. She's a licensed Jungian analyst, a practitioner of mandala assessment, a board-certified music therapist, and also she serves as a faculty and board member of the C.G. Jung Foundation and director of training for the C.G. Jung Institute for Expressive Analysis in New York. The lecture tonight is entitled The Artistic Influences on the Development of C.G. Jung's Red Book. When Carl Jung's Red Book was first put on public display at the Rubin Museum, a series of engaging dialogues occurred, presented by noteworthy scholars in the field. Dr. Selinsky was invited along with the well-known Buddhist scholar, Dr. Robert Thurman, to participate in the Red Book dialogues. So we are very fortunate to have Dr. Jane Selinsky here tonight sharing her insights into Carl Jung's artistic influences and sharing other symbolic insights. So please help me welcome Dr. Jane Selinsky.
Thank you very much. First of all, I have to say that it really is a pleasure to be here, and I'm sure you've heard this so many times before, but it is true. It has been hot, it has been muggy, and coming here is a blessing, believe me. If only just for that, but it is always a wonderful experience to be able to meet people from other places in the country, in the world, and to realize that they too have the same kind of love and desire and connection that Jung has had for so many people. And so to be able to be in a group like this is really an honor, and I really am grateful to be here. And also happy, I've been thanked for coming, but it really is more a thank you to you to have asked me to come, because it really is an honor to be asked and to be able to share with you whatever it is I can bring to you tonight. As you know, the topic is about the artistic influences that have influenced Jung and the Red Book. And there's tremendous controversy over whether or not we can look at Jung as an artist or not. According to Jung, the answer to that is undeniably, no, I'm not an artist. When you talk to a number of artists, they will look at the work, and some of them will give you the sense that this work by far brings forth artistic talent, experience, a wealth that is present. When I've given this talk before, it's very interesting, because when I first started to give the talk, I actually made a commitment and I said, I really feel that Jung is an artist. Well, I had such controversy in the audience every once in a while, I thought, well, no, I'm going to change that. All right, so the stance I take at this point is, look at it and you tell me what you think. Look at it and have the experience for yourself and decide what you think. At the same time, I have come to look at it from the other side, which is that it is not necessarily art. And yet, on the other side of that, it is art. So from where I stand, it basically encompasses both end. And I think from where I stand in terms of looking at Jung and knowing Jung, and because of where he was always with both ends, that it may connect to that. I'm hoping that it does. But for you tonight, what I would like you to do is to take in some of what you see, experience it, and for those that come back tomorrow, we'll see if anything has stirred tonight. in terms of your dreams or in terms of your fantasies, in terms of your images, and possibly move it into the future tomorrow. All right? Just to begin a little bit more formally, and I tend to tell stories and kind of move in and out of it as I see the moment brings it to me. So let me just start formally. Between 1914 and 1930, Jung engaged in self-exploration with his unconscious, which evolved into his monumental book, The Red Book. The New York Times described The Red Book as the holy grail of the unconscious. And the editor of the book, Sonu Shamdasani, wrote, "The Red Book was possibly the most influential book unpublished in the history of psychology. When one encounters the book, it is obvious that both quotes are true, and one feels the desire to bow in awe to Jung's massive undertaking and accomplishment." The distinctive Red Book, which contains calligraphy, is written in Latin and in German. It is beautifully detailed and has beautiful detailed illustrations. The Red Book has been equated with the medieval manuscript, the Book of Kells. In Jung's text, he also gave special prominence to the drawing of mandalas, the sacred circle. The mandalas, drawings, and illustrations all contributed to the evolution of Jung's future theoretical thoughts and his future work. In addition to the development of his future theories, the Red Book revealed Jung, as I said, to be a very gifted artist and calligrapher. Historically, he referenced himself as a scientist and not an artist, as I said before. However, the Red Book revealed Jung to have artistic talent beyond what he would identify with. And it is apparent that there have been influences on his art. What I hope to do tonight is to talk about Jung's encounter with the mandala, which first began in 1896, and to mention that to you, when he sat in a seance with his cousin, Helene. And we'll look at what experiences he had in his youth with art and the artists that appealed to Jung, some of the travels that he was involved in, some of the associations with his art, and his movement towards the symbolic way of working. When we first look at Jung, it's much like a story. First of all, he started out as a very young child, being connected to art. And as he was involved in the art, he had what we would call these imaginary figures. Going back to the seances, first of all, Jung partook in the seances with his cousin Helene for many, many sessions. And as he took part in these sessions, around when he was about 21 years old, he had a series of sittings. And his cousin Helene, as you might know, had mediumistic abilities. Jung found out that during the trance states that would take place, that different personalities would come forth, and that she could call up these personalities upon suggestion. Dead relatives appeared, and she would become completely transformed into these figures. She unfolded stories of her relatives, of previous incarnations, and articulated a mystical cosmology represented as the mandala. So this was the first time that he had an encounter with the word mandala, from what I have found in terms of my reading and my research. Her spiritualistic revelations went on for a long time. However, after a while, she, as some of you may know, was looked at as a fraud. However, this had a very strong influence on Jung in terms of what he was actually able to do in the future in terms of going into his trance state, which was part of that active imagination process, where he would bring himself into a meditative trance-like state, and in the trance-like state would be able to bring forth the images. And for him, this was the beginning of this idea of the active imagination, which had its start within the trance state that Helene actually brought him into, and how he was brought into it by watching her and utilized that information into the future. We can also see that this had a strong connection to the mediumistic work that was very popular around the turn of the century throughout Europe. And he was involved in this because of his relatives, and also utilized that, as I said, with his active imagination and bringing himself into the trance state. So this was the beginning of that for him. Now, one of the biographers, the newest biographer, Deirdre Baer, who writes about Jung, talks about Jung actually first having an encounter with this little mannequin man, all right? If some of you remember the story in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, she goes into it a little bit more in detail about how Jung actually had a pencil case. And in this pencil case, what he did on the top of it was to carve a tiny mannequin at the end of a ruler. And this little man was about 2 inches long, and he dressed this particular father-like figure in a cloak that looked like the elders, that looked like his father and looked like the elders of the village. They had a top hat, had a frock coat, and boots that colored themselves as a dark black. So early on as a child, Jung was able to carve this particular pencil case on the top of his ruler and was actually beginning to work with his hands and doing some carving. What you'll notice as these go through, what there is in one of the folios is a picture of one of the men who have a top hat and a cloak. All right, if you could imagine that, that's very similar to what he was actually carving on the top of his pencil box. All right, so as that comes through, you might note that that was what it looked like. So early on, he was doing this. Now, the other thing that he would get involved in was working with stones. And as you know, he carved his house. He carved the large stone outside of his lake house in Bollingen. He carved many things within that house. This started way back, right? Goes back to when he was a child. And as a child, he had a talismanic stone, okay, which he took from the bank of the Rhine. And he thought of this stone as a gift to this little mannequin man. All right, so this particular stone he painted. And he painted the stone with watercolor. So early on, again, he's usually using watercolor and he's using stones. The stone looked like it was divided in half. Had two halves, an upper half and a lower half. So even in this symbol, you can see that it's a precursor to something that was theoretical way down the road in terms of the halves. And talking about and looking at the halves and the both ends of things. He believed that this little man had shared a great secret with him. All right. Now, the other thing is that this little mannequin was provided with a library, okay, from Jung. And Jung used to put these little tiny scrolls of paper upon which he had written letters. And he thought that these letters had a secret language that was of his own invention. And his own invention of this language was to provide something for the mannequin. So he felt that this was the mannequin's private library. So this was something, again, that Jung was doing as a very young child. First of all, he's got the carving of the man, he's got the stones, and he's creating these little scripts and providing something for the man's library, for the mannequin's library. So these are things early on that occurred. Now, when he was about 11, what happens is he's sent off to Basel, to the gymnasium, and he is now attending school in a whole different area, in a whole different town. Previously, he had been a student that was esteemed in his father's town. He did very well in his Latin, and he did very well in his religious Bible studies. However, what happens in Basel is he's in a whole different economic element. He's poor. He has to walk about a mile and a half every day to school. It's very arduous for him, walking back and forth. Now, the other students came from a much higher economic level than Jung did. They all knew French. They all knew German. For poor Jung, he didn't know French, and he stumbled in his German, and he had a very thick accent where he mumbled, okay? And so he had the dialect of his village where he was, you know, easily misunderstood in the midst of the other students. And so what usually happens in cases like that, you've got somebody new that comes into the school, they're not as good. What happens? We know what happens, all right? Fights start, quarrels start. The students in the school start picking on poor Jung, and he then takes on this whole anxiety about going to school. One situation arises where he gets into this fight and he's pushed to the ground. Then he starts these fainting spells, all right? The fainting spells don't help anything because the more he gets into these fainting spells, the less he really wants to go to school, right? Makes sense? So what happens eventually is that he's taken out of school. Now, while he was in school, he was often ridiculed for his math because he was terrible in math, okay? His art classes, interestingly enough, he was ridiculed in his art classes also because they felt that he had an utter incapacity for art, all right? Imagine. When you look at something like this. Barbara Hanna, in her work, Life and Work, in her book, Life and Work, explains that drawing classes usually consisted of soulless copying and that Jung could only draw when something stirred his imagination, which made sense. So they were forced to do technical things in art, and this was not something that he actually felt good about. So he was ridiculed for his art and also ridiculed for his math. So he became much more anxious on top of what was going on with the students in the class, and the fainting spells kept going on, and he finally is pulled out of school, as I had said. Now, his father had been a pastor, and he was a pastor in the Basel Psychiatric Mental Hospital. Continued the fainting spells to the point where he was sent off to a friend of his father's and stayed with the friend. However, he never recovered as well as they had anticipated during this period of time. What happens next is his father and his friend are in the parlor having a discussion about the fact that his father doesn't know what he's going to do with Jung, has no idea what he's going to do because he cannot afford to support his child for the rest of his life if he can't get a job or he can't get work. Well, what happens next is Jung actually hears this and starts to snap out of it. Okay? Interesting. He hears it and realizes that that doesn't want to be him and wants definitely not to be a burden to his family, not to be a burden to his father. So he starts to get on his feet, goes back to school, takes a little bit of time to kind of get into it, but eventually he becomes an excellent student. All right, so we have all of this as history and backdrop to what's going on at school and what actually happened with his early experiences in art. Now, he did have formal art training in school because that was part of the curriculum, so we know that. Now, some of his experiences in his youth when he was in Basel was that he would visit the art museums, and he was particularly drawn to specific works of the Dutch painters. Towards the end of his studies, he was much occupied with painting for about a year. His paintings from this period were landscapes in a representational style and show highly developed technical skill and fine technical proficiency. For any of you who were able to see the display, either at the Rubin or in LA or in Washington, what was on display was also some of his acrylic watercolors that were similar to landscape drawings of the Dutch painters. Absolutely beautiful, okay? Absolutely incredible, the kind of fine work that one was able to see in what was on display in terms of his work with the landscape drawings. So he already spent a lot of time in museums, and in about 1900, when he was about 25, he was doing that. Then in about 1902-03, he left his post at the Bergholzi, and he went to Paris to study with the leading French psychologist, Genet, who was lecturing at the college in France. During his stay, he devoted much time to painting and, again, visiting museums, going frequently to the Louvre. He paid particular attention to ancient art, Egyptian antiquities, the work of the Renaissance, particularly Fra Angelico, Leonardo da Vinci, Rubens, and Hals. He bought paintings and engravings and had paintings copied for the furnishings of his new home. He painted in both oil and in watercolor. And then in January 03, he went to London and visited museums in London. And there he paid particular attention to the Egyptian, the Aztecs, the ink collection at the British Museum. Now, when we get to the Red Book, and particularly during the early stages of the Red Book, we see that he also says himself that he possessed a catalog of the graphic works of Ravon, and he studied him. He was also likely to have encountered his works when he was in Paris, where he spent a lot of time in the museums. It was here that there were strong echoes of the symbolic movement that appeared in the paintings that we see in the Red Book. By the time Jung was 35 years old, he went on a bicycle tour to northern Italy with his colleague Hans Schmidt, where he visited Ravenna, he visited the frescoes and the mosaics, and made a deep impression, the deep impression that he left at the land and took back with the art was in the mosaics. And again, when you look through these, you see clearly the strong influence of the mosaic art that comes through from his trips to Ravenna. You see strong use of color, and you see the mosaics, and you see two-dimensional figures which give you a sense of perspective. He loved Ravenna so much that he visited a second time. So there's a very strong sense of these mosaic-like drawings that he has done. Now, in 1913, Jung travels to New York, where he was likely to have attended the Armory Show, which was the first major international exhibition of modern art in the United States. That show ran from March 15th, and Jung left for New York on March 4th. So, considering that he had such a love of art, it's most likely that he attended this particular show. He also referred often to Marcel Duchamp's paintings, particularly the nude descending the staircase. And this he did particularly in 1925, when he gave a seminar which had caused a lot of fervor because of the showing of this particular nude drawing. Jung also referred to having studied a course of Picasso's work. Given the lack of evidence of the extent of the study, Jung's knowledge of the modern art probably derived from more his connection and his direct acquaintance, and not necessarily formally studying it. Contacts during the First World War between the members of the Zurich School and the artists were also present in Jung's work. There was a movement called the Dada School, which was a cultural movement that began in neutral Zurich. And it began in Zurich during the time of World War I. And it peaked between 1916 and 1920. The primary movement involved visual arts, literature, poetry, art, art theory, theater, and graphic design, and concentrated into areas of political rejection and a rejection of the prevailing standards of the time. And this was primarily done through the art and through the poetry and through the cultural works that were being created. This also led to a movement into surrealism, where things were moving from the Dada artist that moved through into symbolic art, which was basically then followed by pop art. When we look at the Red Book, we note that Jung drew a mandala in the Black Book, which was the precursor to the Red Book, when he first did his sketches when he was working in the army. And this first particular sketch is located in the appendix of the Red Book. I don't have a copy of that, but it is the circle. I just want to take a moment to show you this in the book. It's this particular one, and I'll hold this up higher after I talk to you. This particular one was the sketch that he had that pulled together his first idea of a mandala. So this was the first mandala that came out of his sketches, and we have the work that came out of those sketches in the appendix here. And in those appendix sections, he outlines in very not elaborate form the first works that he did while he was in the army, and gave a sense of what the mandala was for at this particular point in his history. This particular mandala gave Jung and gave us a sense of his cosmology, which came out of the Sermons of the Dead. And it's a culmination of his psychological cosmology, which is basically cast in the form of a creation myth. So it's very specific in terms of each circle and the symbols that he has delineated in that particular work. In August of 1917, during his military service, which was what I was talking about, in the Appendix A. He had done a number of mandalas. Now, during this time, there was a woman. Her name was Maltzer. And Miss Maltzer wrote to Jung and said to him that the fantasies that were stemming from the unconscious possessed artistic worth and should be considered art. All right. This disturbed Jung tremendously, because when he actually got this, Jung found that her art comment really troubled him, because her comment was not really a stupid comment, because he knew that he had some type of artistic talent. But and he also knew that his modern paintings were an attempt to make art out of the unconscious. But this was something that was tremendously troubling to him and brought tremendous doubts as to whether or not his fantasies were really spontaneous and natural. And what was very interesting is that by the next day, Jung drew a mandala. And the mandala came out to be, and I will try to draw it for you within this space. It almost looked like a flower, right? And it had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 petals. And there was a wedge at the top of this petaled mandala. And Jung knew that when he had drawn this particular mandala, that he gradually knew what the mandala really was. He understood this, right? It had a piece out of it. It was broken off that left off the symmetry. And it was at that point that he said that the mandala was formation, transformation, the eternal mind's eternal recreation. And that it is the self, wholeness, the wholeness of the personality, which when everything is well, is harmonious, but which can bear no self-deception. My mandala images are cryptograms on the state of myself, which were delivered to me each day. So after the comment from Miss Meltzer and the letter from her and his disruption, he came to realize that this mandala was much bigger and much more informative, and that for him it had to be formation, transformation, and the eternal mind's eye's recreation. At the end, when Jung stopped working in Liber Novus, he had written in 1959, "My acquaintance with alchemy in 1930 took me away from it. The beginning of the end came in 1928 when Richard Wolham sent me the text of The Golden Flower, which was an alchemical treatise. There the contents of this book found their way into actuality, and I could no longer continue working on the Red Book. There is one more completed painting in the Liber Novus. In 1928, and we'll point this out, Jung painted a mandala of the Golden Castle. This was the mandala that stopped Jung's drawing after he received the work from Richard Wolham and the information that he received from The Secret of the Golden Flower. So it struck him that the mandala had something Chinese about it. Shortly after Richard Wolham sent him the text of The Secret of the Golden Flower, asking him to write a commentary on it, Jung was struck by it and the timing. So it was very significant for Jung, the timing that he received the request and where he was in terms of his drawing. And what he found was that there was great similarity between that particular folio that I just showed you and the work that was in the Secret of the Golden Flower. The text gave me an understanding of the confirmation of my ideas about the mandala and the circumambulation of the center. This was the first event which broke through my isolation. I became aware of an affinity. I could establish ties with someone and something. The significance of this confirmation is indicated in the lines that he wrote beneath the painting of the Yellow Castle. Jung was struck by the correspondence between the imaginary conceptions of this text and his own paintings and his own fantasies. On May 25th, 1929, he wrote back to Wilhelm, "Fate appears to have given us the role of two bridge pillars, which carry the bridge between the East and the West." Only later did he realize that the alchemical nature of the text was important. He worked on his commentary during 1929, and on September 10th, which is interesting because it's today, in 1929, he wrote to Wilhelm, "I am thrilled by this text, which stands so close to our unconscious." Jung's commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower was a turning point. It was his first public discussion of the significance of the mandala, and for the first time, Jung anonymously presented three of his own paintings from the work as examples of European mandalas and commented on them. To Wilhelm, he wrote in October, "Concerning the same mandalas in the volume, the images amplify one another precisely through their diversity. They give an excellent image of the effort of the unconscious European spirit to grasp Eastern work. The connection between the European unconscious spirit and the East became one of the major themes in Jung's future work." And so, what we can see is from early on, Jung starts out as a child who plays with his hands, plays and creates the mannequin, creates the stone, works with the stone, has the opposites on the stone, works with lettering and calligraphy on his little pieces of paper that he gives to the mannequin. And we see as he goes back to Basel, he learns how to spend time with the museum work, even though he's being rejected by his classmates and he's being told in the classroom that he isn't a good artist and he isn't a good student. And from that time, he moves on into Paris when he's studying psychology but spending a lot of time in the museums, learning a lot about the different works that bring us into antiquity and into the Renaissance and into mythology. And he continues with his work and continues to find the mandala. The mandala in this particular text often does not look like the usual mandalas. He works with these mandalas and finds that the mandala is emanating from the center and that the center helps Jung integrate and to contain. And in that containment and in that unification is able to engage the unconscious and to work with the unconscious and to bring forth and engage with the works of art. And so when we look at whether or not Jung is an artist or not an artist, one looks at the art coming from the unconscious being created. Often that's also what happens with an artist, that it brings forth something that needs to be brought into new life, similar to what Jung did in terms of going into himself, going into that trance-like meditative active imagination, and coming up. The artwork for Jung was to bring up the emotion, to be able to engage in the drawing as a dialogue, to be able to engage in the emotion of looking at the work and then bringing it to another level. So the work for him was a dialogue between what had come forth, but also what then came back to him as he engaged in the looking of it. Like what you're doing here tonight, as you look at, as you take in, it's like being able to project onto any of these particular folios something that stands out. So if I were to ask you, as you've been watching them, which one stands out for you? See if there's one that really holds on to your memory at this point in time. And to ask yourself why that might be. For Jung, this was a regular process. It's the process and the product. Producing the work, bringing it back, engaging, identifying. So, was he an artist? Was he not an artist? For the purpose of what he was doing here, he was not an artist. It was an expression of his unconscious. But he happened to have artistic talent. He happened to have training. He happened to have an interest that was able to culminate in his work. And when I was first preparing this, I contacted an artist friend of mine that is quite seasoned in her work and her life. And she too was a calligrapher. And this was something I often thought to myself, how did Jung ever do this? You know, the precision, the amount of time, the containment of the art piece of it alone. Okay, you can see when you look closer at the book, and sometimes you can pick it up when you look at some of these, you know, the lines that one has to draw for calligraphy, you know, where the dots are on both sides. You know, and before you start, you have to put those dots, and you have to draw your lines, and you have to stay within the lines. And I remember when I was in high school, one of the things I had to do was to be in a calligraphy class. And I can tell you, we only had to produce something this big, and there were lots of mistakes that I made, believe me. So I cannot even imagine this and the precision that's here. But again, that was something that they learned in school. So for Jung, it's almost like writing, you know, because he had learned it. He used it. So it's much more familiar. Came, you know, because of his training. One of the things that this artist friend of mine said, who happened to be a calligrapher, when I was trying to see what real artists that had history and training would say, said to me, "Thank you for letting me go to this treasure. I had no idea of Jung's artistic talent, especially in my area of lettering and illumination. He's a master of design and diagrammatics, of color, and in creating." When I connected with her and asked her to just give me a feel, an overall feel for her work, for his work, knowing, you know, that she was a seasoned calligrapher and she was a seasoned artist, hearing from her, who really didn't know too much about Jung, what she felt as an artist viewing someone else's work, and hearing her esteem for his production. I felt a little bit stronger with me saying, I do feel that Jung was an artist. However, his reason for doing what he did was not for art. It was for the internal communication and the expression and receiving back from the art the message that he could bring back from it. So I think it's a both end, and it'll be interesting for us to have a little discussion about what you think may be the significance of Jung as an artist or not an artist. So I think what we'll do is take a small break for maybe about 15 minutes or so. Thank you. Okay, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts as to what you think about Jung as an artist. A yes artist or not such an artist?
Well, I've been wrestling with this question all evening in my mind. Is Jung an artist? Is he not an artist? Where does one draw the line? How does one draw the line?
That's a good question.
Right.
Right. And part of the answer to it is, I think if you look at it from the perspective of why is something produced, okay? When you think of art and ask yourself, why is it produced? Most artists come out of a process, come out of an internal inspiration of creativity. I think part of the answer, as I would answer you, would be if the work is coming out of that kind of a process, okay, it's one form of art, as compared to whether or not you ask me to draw this room and we need a sketch to put outside with a description of where to come. That may be a form of art, but it's not the type of art that comes from the internal world, the internal creative place that produces a product, a creation. So to me, that makes the difference of what is art and what is not art. So, you know, you're... Yes?
So are you saying that because this... that people will say, oh, this is simply a part of his field. You know, he's into psychology and such, and so this simply reflects, this is his technical illustration for his field, and so therefore he's not the artist because this is too involved with what he does for a living. I have a graphics background myself. I'm familiar with the nitpicking that goes on between, you know, illustrators and artists and such as to who is true and who isn't. So I guess I would ask, what did his peer group at the time, were they familiar with his artistic endeavors? Did they have an opinion about this? And is it an issue these days because people are arguing, oh, well, this is just his illustrations for his books, as opposed to something separate from what his...
Okay. He did show the book to a few of his friends, okay? Whether or not there was a large discussion as to whether or not this was art or not, I have not found anything yet written about that. But he did show it to his wife, and he did show it to Tony, and they would sit down at points and look at it and discuss it. Okay. In terms of people now, it's really interesting because more people say it's not art, as compared to them saying it is art. And their reason for it is the reason he did it and how he did it, which was not for art itself, but for the process. And another reason that I heard was that when you look at it, and I'm not an artist, okay, that when you look at it, you really can see that he's not truly an artist. That's the debatable point, but I have heard that. Okay. Okay, and I think he's trying to catch you, so if you can just speak as loudly as possible, that would be wonderful.
Well, certainly one thing is in the art that it touches with emotion.
Mm-hmm. And I think it gives us, obviously, a point to project onto. And that's why I asked you, as you were watching some of these, to pick out one or maybe two that might have grabbed you. It's like, what is it that you're able to project onto this from, you know? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Somebody else. Yes.
It might be debatable whether Jung was an artist, but I think it's totally clear he had an artist self.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
And that kind of resolves it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't his primary self. It wasn't mm-hmm. his identity or anything, but he clearly had an artist in him.
Right. Right. He definitely had an artist within him that was fairly talented, I think. Somebody else have something else they want to say?
I think when I see these images of him, so in the time frame that he started working on these images, it's quite a period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The active imagination and all those processes of thinking going on, he just wanted to kind of reflect all that rich world onto
paper.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of help to help himself to formulate
right.
this thought.
Right. I think that that's a very significant point that you've made, and I'm glad you brought it back, because that's also one of the arguments, that it was the process. It wasn't art. It was a way to bring back to him the experience and to get deeper into the emotion and connect it to the emotion of it. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
This makes a really
No, what I mean is,
say more.
There was a little less soul in it, maybe, and a little less attention to process, and that it would be considered more artistic. You know, I'm not saying you're making that case, but you know, whoever the they are that we've been talking about, you know, that suggests maybe it's not art. It just seems like you know, like maybe art critics and art historians might not call it art. Mm. But I'm guessing most artists would. Hmm. Would feel a kinship with it, you know, like that that we're working from a soul place.
Hmm.
And it also struck me when we were conversing that I think typology is really important in discussing this, because...
Can you say more on that?
Well, yeah, that I think an intuitive feeling artist is going to create different art than a thinking sensation oriented artists.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to think artists are all these flighty, feeling, intuitive people, and you know, perhaps many are, but not all. You
mm-hmm.
know, and I think that there is a representation of typology amongst people who create art or that are creators, as there are in any segment of you know, the population.
So
in that sense, I think, you know, to just kind of talk about art and big A, or artists with a big A, we need to look at what kind of an artist, you
right.
know, and
right.
what flavor of an artist.
Right, which makes, you know, it's a significant point. It's like, what type of artist? I mean, photographers tend to be much more sensation function people than non-artists. Photographers tend to be much more sensation function than intuitive. You know, I would think a graphic artist would probably, if we look at the large group, one that was a graphic artist might tend toward more sensation, because there might be less, more frustration with being that contained all the time. That's just my hunch. Yeah. Yes.
So obvious question, but if it's not art, what is it?
That was my point. But I have to say, I got a lot of people angry at me when I started to tell them that I thought it was art. It was interesting. You know? Processing.
Illustration, I
think. Illustration, processing. Yes.
If it's not art, you could attempt to say that the picture is a technical drawing that's intended to communicate this, 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 and this.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would disagree on the grounds that for many but not all of these drawings, I feel a connection with a non-verbal but analytical intelligence. And whenever something communicates with me, I'm going to call her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anything that communicates to you, you would call it art?
If I look at an object,
mm-hmm.
three-dimensional or otherwise, and it seems to me that I can hear somebody saying something to me, whether or not I can hear what it is, then I feel that there is an artistic energy communicating through. That just sounds horribly woo-woo, but that's the way it is.
Okay. Yes. Can you just say it a little bit louder?
I was hoping we might move off that topic a little bit, because I sort of feel like if you feel like you're an artist, you produce art.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But what would you like to bring up?
What I'd like to explore are some of the symbolism in his work. I mean, he uses, you know, often this sort of a base, kind of triangular base, or, you know, some of the other symbols.
One of the things that's interesting that he stressed, and Shyam Dasani said the same thing, was that it would be important not to stop and give you the technical pieces of what he says about this, that, or another drawing, but to really first experience it, and then to go back, if you're curious, to read more about it. I mean, you can see throughout this set of many folios that there are some reoccurring themes, all right? And you can see that there are reoccurring symbols. And you can almost see, particularly, where some of them morph into each other. I mean, there's this... see if I could find it. Again, hard to see, but, and I will show you a few separate folios, but here is one figure, all right, that has the blue and white form, the Kabiri man type figure. He's the recurring helper, and he's present in this particular slide, and he also repeats in 123, you see the same figure. So how they're morphing into similar strains. So here's the same figure. He comes out and he starts to water. Okay? And then you see him again, 154. Okay. You don't see him here. 125. You see him again. Okay. The figure. All right. So for him, there's significance, obviously, because he's using the similar form. He also repeats this you don't see it here, but this gives you a culmination of where this particular serpent is regenerating in the heaven. Okay, so all of these have a similarity, and this comes out of an analysis that Ann Ulanoff, who's also from the New York area, had done. She had looked at the continuation of this particular set of folios that I just mentioned to you and how they morph into one another. So there are certain symbols that you're going to see that repeat often in this particular work. Anybody else? Question? Comment?
I think what are these symbols?
Well, see, that's the point I just said that I can't tell you. Not that I can't tell you, but the important piece is that you need to experience them first. You need to project into them. And at some point, take the text and look at it if you wish to go that far into it. But not to stop and to tell specifically what this symbol is for, what this symbol is for, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that there's great curiosity about that in general, coming out of an audience and coming from, you know, people that see these. But that is a better way to experience them. To experience them, reflect on them, project into them, and then go to the book. Okay? Yes.
I think perhaps we need to start off a discussion like this, discussing what the definition of artist is in this day and age, post-romantics. Because I'm sure that if you talk to somebody who maybe is living drawing Dutch paintings 300-400 years ago, he'd have continuing images, whether he was a still life artist or drawing people. Mm-hmm. He might think of it as a trait. He had a skill. He was able to reproduce people in such a way, and that's how he made his living. We might not think of that as art if we looked at it from that point of view, though I'm sure many people would say that this man was an artist. But there's a great deal of what I think of therapeutic art out there, and a lot of romantic self-indulgence is what an artist is. So maybe we need to discuss that first before we go into whether he was an artist or not.
Okay. Let me just give you the Wikipedia definition. Okay. Art is the process or product of deliberately arranging elements in a way that appeals to the senses or emotions. It encompasses a diverse range of human activities, creations, and modes of expression, including music, literature, film, sculpture, and painting. The meaning of art is explored in a branch of philosophy known as aesthetics. See, I did think about starting that way, but I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. But I was ready. Yes.
Well, this discussion reminds me of trying to agree on what is true. And the thing I'm most interested in, after all this, is what's going on internally with these people that got so angry.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about that?
Yes.
Well, first of all, some of them I didn't know. Some of them were just sitting in the audience like you were. Right? And so that's part of it. Some of the others, I'm going to put them in a category. The category would be highly educated, people who I would, my assessment would be that they felt that they had a corner on truth. Okay? And were not open to exploring something as a possibility and took the traditional line of Jung said he wasn't an artist, he's not an artist. Yes. What is your this? If you go through the text, he does explain and give you discussion about what he's doing. Or he'll give you, some of them are not explainable, but he does give you explanation of some of the work, but not all. No. No, that's the part, I don't think you heard me. That was the thing that I kept saying. It's not good to do that. It's better for you to experience first and then go into it. Okay? Somebody else?
Do you think some of these people that might have been upset by your suggesting that Jung was an artist would feel that if Jung were more recognized and as an artist, it would diminish his recognition as a scientist, because in a narrow way of thinking, you can't be both?
That's possible. I mean, and at the same time, that's also, I think, why Jung did not want himself also to be recognized as an artist or a mystic, that it would take him away from the scientific identity that he so chose and wanted to be. So I think that that's also another element of it, that if he were this, then he couldn't be this. And certainly in that day and age, if he were an artist or a mystic, it would have taken him further away from the science that he so wanted to be identified with.
The anthropologist Lauren Isley had the same problem when he wrote his poetry.
Can you just say that one more time?
The anthropologist Lauren Isley had the same problem with his poetry.
Yes, I think we'll take your comment and then we'll bring closure. Yes.
Well, question. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're suggesting look at the pictures and then read the text as a book. I think I recall from the April event with the editor down in Portland that he actually suggested
I'm not the editor, obviously. And this is like the, is he an artist or not an artist?
Yes.
I would say, from an experiential perspective, I would look at the picture, feel into it, project into it, and then go to it. That's my opinion. But not the editors. Okay? I hope to see you certainly tomorrow, some of you. And tomorrow what we will do is we'll go more into the mandala, do more experiential work, and I'll also try to give you a sense of, in doing the experiential work, how you can look at it, you know, from your own perspective, from your own personal work, and from the people who will participate, and what you can learn from it in terms of using it for yourself and or slash your own clients, if you have clients. All right, so that's what we're hoping to do tomorrow, go more deeply into the mandala and to look at how we can apply it and use it for ourselves and also for more of your work. All right, and I thank you all for your contributions and what you've added. Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.